Hello, and welcome to episode 139 of SMARTS, which as we all know stands for...
Supreme Mensch Attacks Ruffians Through Shocks.
Ooh. Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, it took a moment. No, it's a Black Lightning-related acronym.
I get it.
It's a Zapronym. Zap. Work in progress.
I get it.
Finish the intro.
My name is Rudiger Ku, podcaster, a.k.a. Trevor, and your name is...
Julia Guglia of internet fame dash podcaster.
Correct.
Yay. And if we sound a little tired, it's because Rudiger Jr. kept us up for a little while. But we soldier on.
Correct.
Yes. So, is it time for news?
It is.
Yay!
Except there is no news this week.
Well, that in itself is news.
So now it is time for Comics of the Week.
Awesome.
So, we're a little behind in comics, but I picked a couple that I thought were noteworthy. So, one of the ones I picked was The Wildstorm, Michael Cray, number 5.
Nice.
Because I've really been enjoying this series,
me
and
too.
It's quite different. It's a bit more formulaic than I expected, especially given how unconventional the Wildstorm series is. This one is basically every two issues, he's given the job of assassinating a different...
Justice League member
in this alternate universe.
Yeah.
So, it's...
Where
it's
they're all
pretty
evil.
Procedural. It's like a procedural thing, mm-hmm. much more than the craziness that's going on in the main book. But it's been really interesting so far, and these are interesting, like, dark mirror versions of
dark twists.
Green Arrow and then The Flash and now Aquaman.
Yeah.
And this one is interesting with Aquaman being like a...
Genetically altered.
Like a creature from the Black Lagoon, legendary, yet member of like a noble family ruling over a... coastal town and yet like a weird merman guy who with human sacrifices and everything. But it's interesting, so I'm really enjoying the series, and the main Wildstorm series is pretty complex and stylistically very different than this, so when you're having a harder time following it, but you're really enjoying the Michael Cray spinoff.
It's true, I'm enjoying both of them. It's just that like you mentioned, like, I don't have a head for these types of facts, and so it comes out once every 2 weeks, right? And by then I've forgotten
what does
The Wildstorm?
No, every month.
Every month.
With a skip month in between arcs.
Right. Yeah, so I just can't hold my facts in my head. I can't remember who Io is and who Skywatch is. I mean, I remember the names and I remember the theories of what they are, but like, they jump back and forth and resume conversations in the middle of other conversations, and then you've got like a month in between, and I can't hold it in my head long enough. So I'm having a frustrating time reading through the book. I think I'll do better with it as an anthology collection, so that's my intent right now, is to just wait until they all come out and read it all back to back so I don't forget things from one issue to the next.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do like it. I just, you know, bad memory. Memory of a goldfish. Hello.
And then the other one I picked this week that I really enjoyed was Dark Knights Rising, The Wild Hunt, which is a Dark Knights metal... spin-off co-written by Scott Snyder and Grant Morrison, with all the crazy multiverse House of Heroes. Mm-hmm. Each universe has its own resonant frequency, you know, firing antimatter dark multiverse baby universes from one ship to another ship to turn them into a ship-sized multiverse bullet that will destroy the House of Heroes. Meanwhile, Detective Chimp is losing his intelligence for some reason, and the Metal Men and Red Tornado and the cadre of mad scientists from Oolong Island are there. So you got Tio Moro and Professor Ivo and Will Magnus and Veronica Kale and Egg Fu, and it's just a lot of crazy stuff and crazy Grant Morrison concepts. And the Dark Knights, Red Death, Flash Batman gets... like inverted, and so the Barry Allen personality takes over and his color changes, but then that was all part of the Batman Who Laughs plan to, like, it's crazy Grant Morrison stuff where you've got it crazy high concepts and you've got to read it a couple of times to sort of fully understand what's happening. But I really enjoyed it, and I need a little bit more Grant Morrison in there sometimes, so I'm glad he's finally doing a bit more work, because all the stuff we were promised, the future the sequel to Multiversity, the graphic novels he was going to do set across the multiverse, the Arkham Asylum 2, all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Even his Wonder Woman Earth 1 second volume, which is probably the most imminent, still doesn't seem to be terribly imminent. So it's been too long since I've read some crazy Grant Morrison ideas. So I really enjoyed this one too.
Yeah, me too. It's a good one. I've been having a lot of fun reading the Hal Jordan and Green Lantern Corps. So, I mean, that would be my pick if I had to pick one from the last couple weeks where we fell behind, just because I like the fact that the idea that Hal Jordan's ring is made up of his will is still a thing that's prevalent, and it became important in the last issue once again because of him facing off against Zod and Zod taking their power rings, his and Kyle's rings, hostage. I like that moment where Hal is like, he doesn't know that this ring isn't just a trinket assigned to me. This ring is me. I forged it out of my own will, and he doesn't know that fact. And it was pretty, I don't know, I'm having a lot of fun with the more fluffier, I suppose.
If I had one qualm about that one, it would be that I feel like they've done a pretty good job since Hal came back. I don't know how long it's been, 10 years ago or something like that, of giving him and Kyle their own space so that they are their own characters and one isn't necessarily overshadowing the other. Mm-hmm. But in this arc, I feel like, and it's because they both got their, I mean, Kyle got the worst end of a butt whooping from Zod's family. And so he's practically near death. So it's understandable. But I really feel like in this story, he's really playing second fiddle to Hal.
Yeah.
I enjoy the stories that show that, you know, Hal is always going to be, ever since he came back, and it's even been, you know, he was after his death and his, then, you know, they sort of retconned it and everything so that it wasn't really his fault. He's, you know, it's, the whole thing is like he's the greatest Green Lantern of all time and everything. And he always will be so long as he's the one that's going to be in the movies and the cartoons and everything. It's, you know, just like Barry Allen is always going to be the best Flash there ever was, even though if you actually look at the comics, Wally surpassed him in every way after Barry died and then Barry came back, but all of a sudden he was the golden child again. And it was like Wally never existed. They've been better at handling Kyle afterwards. Like he's had his own book, so they didn't need to be in the same. No, but now that they're in the same book, and I feel like with Kyle going back from being a White Lantern to a Green Lantern again, and even wearing the costume he wore when he was a rookie, I get what they're trying to
do.
They're trying to recapture the whole nostalgia thing and bring the characters back to their basics. I get that. But I think sometimes they go a little too far and he comes across as being like the inexperienced kid sidekick to Hal Jordan when he's seen and done things. I mean, in the old continuity, I guess. Who knows how much of that is still in play. But when he's seen and done things that... I mean, one of my favorite Kyle Rayner moments was always, and Hal had been dead for years, Kyle was the only Green Lantern now, but he still felt like he was never going to live up to Hal Jordan's legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel, actually, the Sandman, the same one that's in Dark Knight's Metal right now, this was in Grant Morrison's JLA, of course, as almost all of my favorite comic book moments, was leading them through a dream world to try to rescue a child who had reached out for them for help from the Justice League through his dreams, even though he and his whole town were being controlled by Starros.
Oh.
And so Daniel was leading the Justice League through a dream world to try to help these. And Kyle was sort of standing there while others were doing something. And Daniel said to him, "This man, Jordan, who occupies so much of your thoughts, who is he?" And Kyle was like, "Oh, man, he was the greatest Green Lantern ever. Everybody always tells me that, I'll never be as good as him." And Daniel just says, "You will surpass him." And Kyle says, "What are you talking about? Like, everybody always says he was the greatest. What could I possibly know that he didn't?" And Daniel says, "Fear. You will surpass him."
Huh.
Because Kyle is the everyman. Kyle was the only one chosen randomly.
Yeah.
Not because he didn't know fear or could overcome fear. And so the reason why Parallax was able to take over Hal Jordan was because fear was his blind spot.
Right.
And so it could get at him and eat him away and destroy his life. Mm-hmm. And it ultimately ended up destroying the whole core. But because Kyle is more in touch with all these other aspects of himself, he's not the hands on his hips, fearless test pilot character.
Yeah,
he's just a guy. He's a comic book
superhero.
Artist.
Yeah.
So he knows things and is aware of things and is
in touch
with things that Hal never could.
Yeah.
And ultimately, even though Grant Morrison didn't write JLA for much longer after that, later writers came along and kind of fulfilled that by having him become the White Lantern and everything.
Yeah.
Like, he's the only person that's ever mastered
all
the different emotions and was able to embody all of them. So ultimately, it did kind of come true. And the way that he was eventually able to play such an instrumental role in bringing Hal back, too, really played into that. So Geoff Johns picked it up a little bit, too. So I always liked that about him. But, you know,
it's a nice setup.
But when the book kind of, when Hal was the main, had his Green Lantern book, and then there was Green Lantern Corps, they could kind of do their own things. But then when the main, quote-unquote, main Green Lantern book became Simon and Jessica's book, and the Green Lantern Corps became Hal Jordan in the Green Lantern Corps, now the book has to service Guy, Kyle, Hal, and Kilowog, Salak, all these other characters, but three main human Green Lanterns, plus the Guardians and all that.
Right.
And Simon and Jessica get their own book. It's not called Hal Kyle in the Green Lantern Corps. It's called Hal Jordan in the Green Lantern Corps.
Right.
So it's always going to be his book with the others playing a supporting role. So that's a bit of my qualm there. I wish that they would give him kind of his own thing again. And
yeah, have it him seems be, like have he's a little better.
Maybe
villain.
Got a new costume at the end of this one, which maybe or it could just be a temporary it's thing. I kind of like it.
Yeah, I dig it too, but I think it's just story related, just because of what Hal did to save him.
Yeah, so probably.
I think this is just a mashing of their two costumes for the purposes of just this story, and then he'll return to, I don't know, a different costume after.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my take on that.
I agree.
So should we move on to your pop quiz?
Okay, ready.
Okay, so given that we are closing in on the end of the current seasons that we are watching of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Voyager, I thought I would quiz you about alien races from those two shows.
Okay.
So I'm going to name an alien race, and you need to describe that alien race to me in a way that convinces me that you actually remember which alien race it is.
Okay.
So be as specific or generic as you feel you need to be to achieve that.
I will do my best. Okay.
So number one.
Yes.
The Vidians.
Okay. Those are the guys that harvest people's organs. They're the ones that are, they have the phage disease, which makes them basically necrotic for their entire lives, and they need to keep replacing and replenishing their organs and skin tissue, muscle tissue, all the tissues.
Yeah. They're neck rot. Yeah. That's the problem. Their necks are just no good.
Yeah.
All right. Number two.
Yep.
Jem'Hadar.
Oh, okay. These guys are bread soldiers. They live a very short life.
They just
really love bread. They're so happy with bread. They visit up the Paneras all the time. They're the fighting race that are basically the weapon of the not the Obsidian Order, the other guys. I can't remember. The big bad guys in Deep Space Nine. And let's see. I don't know. Have I convinced you yet?
Yeah.
They're addicted to the white. They don't eat. They don't sleep. They just fight.
Remember the full name of the thing that they're addicted to?
I just remember it as the white.
Well, that's the short version of it. There's a longer name. Do you not remember?
No, I don't remember.
It's Ketracel White.
Ketracel White. No, I don't remember that.
All right. Number three.
Yep.
The Ocampa.
Oh, that's Kes's race. They live very short lives.
Do you remember on average how long?
9 years.
That's right.
Yeah.
You remember.
That's it.
All right. Number four. The Vorta.
The Vorta. Oh. No, I don't remember this one. So
it's from Deep Space Nine. Does that help?
The Vorta. No. I don't remember them, so I'm going to take a stab in the dark based on the Deep Space Nine hint and say that they are, I got nothing.
They are the major domos of the Dominion, the guys with the weird ridged ears that go up,
the
that
ridged
are like
the
obsequious butlers
powers.
Of the...
Yeah, 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 they look vaguely pale and blue, and they have telekinetic powers.
Well, they're not blue, they're just kind of pale.
They're a little pale, yeah, they're pale.
Forget about the telekinetic powers, though, because they only had that in that first episode, and they're never mentioned again, so just forget about that.
Jeffrey Combs played the last one.
Yes, Jeffrey Combs is the best Vorta, that's definitely true. One of the best Ferengis also.
Okay, I did not remember that that's the name of their race. Okay.
As Brunt, FCA.
That's all right.
Number five, the Kazon.
Oh, those guys are the ones with the big, big weird faces and the shaggy hairs. No, these guys are basically the
Describe the makeup of their society, though. Are they a single unified society?
No, they're not. They're
kind of warring, this is a leading question.
No, here. I know. They're warring factions.
Just how factionized is their society?
Yeah, I don't know. They're like nine tribes and they're always warring against each other. They're not unified.
Can you name one of the sects?
No, I can't. Something like Lore or Laron or something like that. I don't remember.
Well, the main two that we've heard the most of so far are the Ogla and the Nistrum. The Nistrum is the one that has Seska and what's the name of the main guy? Okulla, right? Maj Kulla?
Yes. Yeah.
And then there's the Oglamar, and there's at least one or two others I think we've heard. I think in the episode where they all came to meet at that tete-a-tete.
Right.
And there were the assassination attempt,
yeah.
Yeah, you remember.
Yeah.
All right, so number six, the Breen.
The Breen. Oh, wait a minute. Aren't they the ones that had the Kazon suppressed for...
No, that's not correct. No, the Breen are from Deep Space Nine.
Oh.
Although I think they were mentioned in TNG first? I could be wrong about that.
Oh, wait. Okay, I got you. Yeah, the Breen are the people that had... Major Kira hates this Cardassian above all others, and then he had a daughter.
You're like three levels removed. You're not thinking of the person imprisoned by the Breen. You're thinking of the father of the person imprisoned by the Breen.
Yeah, exactly. But the Breen.
Are you thinking of Gul Dukat's daughter, yes, Tara Zial?
Yes, I am thinking of Gul Dukat's daughter, Tara Zial, yes. She was kept on...
Describe the Breen physically.
They like... cold temperatures.
What do they wear?
Well, all I ever saw them wearing is a giant heat suit because they kept the oppression camp on a hot planet. And so they
it's more like a cold suit. Their planet is very cold, right. So they had to wear those suits to live on a hot planet.
Right. No, yeah, I know. They had, well, it's a heat protection suit because, again, desert planet, but cold species, cold-blooded species, so they needed to insulate themselves. So I never actually saw what the Breen looked like.
Maybe that will be important later.
Yeah, it probably will be because the Cardassians do not like cold temperatures, and Gul Dukat had a threat at one point to be reassigned to Breen for some...
No, he was going to reassign the guy that was macking on his wife to the embassy on Breen. That was his his dream of what to do when he regained his standing in Cardassian society.
It came up again, though, at some point where he had that threat leveled against him. Like, oh, I'll probably be reassigned to Breen or something like that. I don't know. It was a throwaway line.
All right.
But yeah, okay. I think I earned that one.
I kind of led you to it, but maybe.
No, I didn't lead you to it. You remember I was like three levels deep.
Well, you started by saying there were the guys that were oppressed by the Kazon
But then you said no, it was the other show.
That's why I stopped you from saying an incorrect answer. Then you eventually got it, yes.
Yeah, but I did get it in my own.
Number seven.
All right.
The Nacene.
Oh, the Nacene.
I'm not sure I would have gotten this one because I think it's only mentioned once in one episode. Although you do see members of this race in two episodes so far.
Really?
Oh. It's a Voyager race, I'll tell you that much.
The Nacene. Oh, wait a minute. Didn't what's his name? The cook and the morale officer, Neelix, have something to do with the Nacene?
No. Are you thinking of the guy that destroyed his planet? Is that who you were thinking of? That might have been the race?
No.
The guy played by, what's his name? Remember who I'm talking about, right? I thought you were thinking of the episode Jatrell, where the guy that had destroyed Neelix's people came to the ship and wanted to help cure him, and then it turned out he was dying. I thought that might have been who you were thinking
of. No, I wasn't, no. Oh, that's a good guess, though. I completely forgot about that entire storyline.
No, I don't think you're going to get it. The Caretaker. In the episode where they met the female Caretaker, we learned that their race was called the Nacene.
Oh.
I think that was told to us by the Okampa, the leader of the Okampa that was sort of traveling with the female caretaker.
No, I would not have guessed that.
Do you remember the name of the female caretaker? Which sounds like the name of like a horror movie franchise.
No.
Suspiria?
Suspiria. That's pretty good.
All right. Last one. Number eight. The Tosk.
Oh, the Tosk are the ones that had oppressed the Kazon.
No. I don't remember that. I know what race you're talking about. I don't remember what it was called. But no, the Tosk was a one-episode race from early in Deep Space Nine.
Deep Space Nine, the Tosk.
Give up?
Nope. Yeah, I have to give up.
I'm trying to think of how to... So we met one guy from this race. He came through the wormhole. He was being hunted. All he would say is, I am Tosk. He was vaguely reptilian looking. He befriended O'Brien. It turned out that his race has no sense of individual identity. They're bred to be hunted by this other race. So actually, interestingly enough, they never made its way into a finished episode, but they were going, after they had introduced the Dominion later on, they were going to have a line in there somewhere that we know that the Dominion are experts at genetic engineering. Like they bred the Jem'Hadar and all this stuff, right? They were going to reveal that, you know, being the major power in the Gamma Quadrant where the Tosk had come from, they were going to retcon it and say that the Dominion were the ones that bred the Tosk
for
this other race as one of their little, you know, side projects.
Wow.
But they never actually made that explicit in the episode.
Wow. Yeah, that's right. I remember.
So you did pretty good. You got five or six.
Yeah, like five out of eight or something.
So should we talk a little bit about our shows?
Sure.
So we're not going to talk in detail about all of our shows yet, but most of them have been on hiatus for a couple of weeks. But I think we want to talk a little bit about recent episodes of Black Lightning, and then also the the season finale of Star Trek Discovery.
Yep.
So did you want to, was there something specific you wanted to say about Black Lightning, aside from the fact that you're just continuing to really enjoy it?
I'm super enjoying it. I think it's incredibly plot rich and lesson rich too, because
how do you feel about this new, I guess it's not really new, but it's coming more to the fore now with Anissa investigating the circumstances of her grandfather's death and this weird conspiracy to experiment on, give a weird vaccine to a number of people that gave them superpowers.
I'm
finding that interesting, mm-hmm. but I'm enjoying that less than the more down-to-earth street-level stuff with the more human... Like, it's kind of like, I would say, maybe with Luke... It's kind of similar to Luke Cage. And I know this is reductive because they're both shows with predominantly black cast, so I don't mean to... But in the way that they were both about sort of the same...
Genetic altering.
No, I just mean like the sort of street-level inner-city life with sort of a gang moving in and sort of... I enjoyed the parts of Luke Cage that dealt with the street level stuff more than when it became a conspiracy about how he got his powers and, you know, corporate interests and stuff like I enjoyed the street level stuff with the gangs and the movers and shakers and the power struggles and how they affected how they affected the little people who got caught in the crossfire.
Yeah.
That's the stuff I'm enjoying more, but like the one with the protests where the people got shot. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I'm enjoying that, and with Tobias Whale's manipulations and learning more about him and his status, I'm finding all that really interesting. The recent thing with his father, that was really cool. I'm enjoying that more than I am the world building with the conspiracies and stuff. I see that becoming like a little plot cul-de-sac where it's just there to give Anissa her own thing to do as she comes into her powers.
Right.
And I'm sure it's going to circle back to the main plot because it does have to do with the circumstances surrounding Jefferson's father's death and what Tobias Whale had to do with it and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even how Jefferson got his powers, maybe why Tobias Whale is now apparently ageless, which we discovered in this episode, which was news to me.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it'll end up coming back to that. But for me, I'm enjoying that less than I am the...
And does that mean his sister is ageless too? Because it
his
seems
sister,
like
whose sister? Tobias Whale's sister.
Because
I don't know necessarily if he got dosed with the vaccine
maybe
and
she didn't. Yeah,
I don't know. We don't have any indication of that.
We have no indication of it. I hope it doesn't turn into too long of a plot thread, though. To answer your question about Anissa's reporter plot thread. I hope it doesn't turn into too long of a story, kind of mirroring what Karen did in the Daredevil series.
Where she became, it did remind me of that.
Yeah, that's kind of like how I was looking at it, because it's interesting when it's done, and it was already done, I felt like, really well in Daredevil, but to have her kind of sleuthing too hard like this may seem a little bit more... like spinning your wheels, because we're already waiting for her to kind of come into her own as Thunder.
It worked well in Daredevil because otherwise that character would have had nothing to do.
Yes,
but here Anissa already has a lot of stuff going on.
Exactly,
she's got this new potential romance with Gray. She's discovering her powers. She's standing up to the local drug dealers and stuff. Not to mention looking out for her sister and being, you know, med school and all that stuff too.
At some point.
She's got enough going on. Like they did. Like Jennifer's got a lot going on too. They didn't need to give Jennifer some subplot where she investigates conspiracies.
Sure.
Like she's got enough on her plate as it is.
Yeah.
So I feel like they gave this to her so that she could have some agency as she becomes her own hero.
Yeah. And maybe discover more about what made her a hero.
Her character didn't need that yet. I feel like it's a little early to have her going off on her own little quest. I feel like she should kind of still be at the discovering her powers. Like all the stuff with putting a hoodie on and beating up those drug dealers on that corner. Even the thing with putting on like a really ridiculous looking costume that she bought from a store and doing some of her own stuff that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, Grace got beat up and those, you know, those whatever they were, bigots or whatever, homophobes, I guess, were trying to give her a hard time behind the bar.
Exactly.
And she fought back against them. And she's like, you know, there are people that need to be fought and everything. That's all fine. But I don't know. I got some like PTSD from the Netflix shows, which often will start off very street level. Jessica Jones did the same thing, actually. Mm-hmm. Started off very street level, but then we learned that there was this secret corporation that might be responsible for her powers. And also, like, it goes that way, you know? And Daredevil started off very street level, but then it became like there's this huge ninja conspiracy that, you know? So I enjoyed the street level.
Versus the chase,
I enjoyed the street level stuff, and this show is so much better at it than... I mean, I don't say it's so much better at than, say, Arrow. They're very different shows. But the street level stuff here feels a lot more real.
Mm-hmm.
Than it does. The stuff on Arrow show. Always felt sort of like...
It's comic book-y. Like,
it's a comic book approximation of street level violence, not actual street level violence.
Exactly.
So, and I want to see them really explore that here before that becomes too mythic, you know, and too much of a big conspiracy
that
everybody gets wrapped in.
Yeah, I agree.
So Star Trek Discovery. So I enjoyed the season finale. I think it was it came across to me as like a little bit of an anticlimax because of the way in which it seemed like so much of the episode was set up for how are they going to disarm this bomb that evil Giorgio had dropped into the heart of Kronos.
Yeah.
And then it just like Laurel walks in and they convince Giorgio to give them the thing and go away. And they give the detonator to Laurel and like use the fact that there's a bomb on your planet to unite all the houses and end the war. And she's like, that's a good idea. And then we see her talk to the other houses for 5 seconds and say, I have this device.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the ships leave Earth and that's the end of the war. It came across a little, obviously I'm being a bit, you know, facetious about it, but it seemed a little, after 15 episodes of build-up, it seemed a little anticlimactic. What I've been hearing people say on podcasts, and which I think I agree with, is maybe, and the season was originally going to be 13 episodes, which is a normal normal short season show. If it had ended with 2 episodes ago, which is when they came back from the mirror universe, if that had been the cliffhanger, they come back from the mirror universe, but they're like, oh my God, wait a minute, we're 9 months too late and the war is over.
Yeah.
And then go into the next season and spend more time resolving the war instead of kind of having to position, like they wrapped up the Ash Tyler thing super quick.
Yep.
Laurel did his thing and all of a sudden did her thing with the lasers in his head and all of a sudden he was fine. Right?
Yeah.
The war kind of ended super quick. And then everybody's happy again, even though a huge section of Starfleet seemingly, or at least 2 or 3 high ranking people that we know of, were seemingly fine with committing genocide.
Yes,
and that's just swept under the rug.
It
did feel a little rushed at the end, and it's I don't know what was going on. Obviously, we talked you know for a long time about the show sort of had a troubled production history, like they lost their showrunner early on, and then it kept getting delayed. I wonder if there was something where they had a certain amount of story, but they discovered, for whatever behind-the-scenes reason, they needed to finish it in one season, maybe because they weren't sure they were going to be able to get Michelle Yeoh back for season 2 because she wanted to commit to some big movie thing or something. And so that's why they added, because literally it was going to be 13, and then they added 2 more episodes really late in the game. Like, I think after the show had started airing, they're like, oh, we're doing 2 more.
So that would explain it, right? Because 2 episodes ago is more or less where
they jumped to. So maybe for whatever reason, maybe it was, and I hope this wasn't it, because I'd like to see artists kind of stick to their guns, but maybe it was the fact that there was so much resistance to the show being like as dark and gritty as it is.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the original plan was to have the war continue into the second season, but when they were getting so much pushback from it being dark and gritty, they made the behind the scenes last minute decision to say, let's wrap up the war at the end of this season and then do more. And we talked before about how their plan for next season is to sort of begin to gradually evolve the tone of the show so that it becomes closer and closer to the original series. And you don't get much more of a blatant signpost of that. The fact that literally the Enterprise shows up at the end, right?
Yeah.
They wanted that to be the thing that they ended on to entice old school fans to come back for season 2. And they couldn't get there unless they wrapped up the war thing first, you know?
Well, they had to, right? Because don't forget that in the TOS, nobody had really even seen Klingons since whatever their last conflict
was. No, they see the Klingons all the time in TOS. You're thinking the Romulans. They hadn't seen the Romulans in 100 years since Earth-Romulan war in the mid-22nd century.
You're right. But the Klingons were no longer at war with the Federation.
Right.
But
what's actually interesting, I was thinking about this the other day. If you remember The Cage, which was the unaired pilot of the original series, the one that starred Captain Pike, the whole first act of that show deals with him being weary from some long military conflict which has just ended, and he's considering leaving Starfleet. He talks to the doctor, which is not McCoy, because it's a different doctor in the pilot, about how he's considering leaving the service, and he's like, oh, what will you do? Like, you're a soldier, you're a member of Starfleet. And so going back and looking at that, like, man, that's really interesting, because that would have been around the same time as this. This is me going off on a little tangent here, but I mean, stuff like that. I wonder if that was in the back of their mind. Like,
I'm sure it
if
was.
This is,
I'm
now
sure
we realize that was the Klingon War that just ended, that he was considering leaving.
But that's what
leaving.
I'm saying, yeah.
So anyway, all of that is interesting. I don't know what they're going to do next season, if they're going to have cast new actors to play Pike, Spock, number one, and have them come over wearing those brown turtlenecks like they were in The Cage and have it be a thing. Or, I mean, part of me thinks they're going to avoid Spock just because it's too loaded. Mm-hmm. They might just say, oh, Spock, he's serving on the Enterprise, but he's like on an extended leave right now or something like that. And so right. You just have cast a new actor to play Pike.
And don't
because
forget, Pike, like...
Because Leonard Nimoy and even now Zachary Quinto as Spock mm-hmm. are much more iconic than Jeffrey Hunter, who played Pike in one episode
sure.
that didn't even get aired,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And then later on, they cast a different guy who was blonde to play him as a vegetable in a chair, you know?
Right.
So mm-hmm. that's, I mean, he was great in that one episode,
yeah.
but that's not, he's not Leonard Nimoy. So if you want to cast another 40-year-old actor to play Pike
yeah.
for an arc mm-hmm. in season two, or even... recast, you know, Majel Barrett as number one, because she was, again, only in that one. Obviously, right. she played a lot more roles later on, but the sure. character of number one was only in that one episode. And that may be a bit more sacrosanct, because Majel Barrett is, like, the first lady of Star Trek,
sure.
so maybe that's a bit more sacrosanct, but I think at least you have Pike and some of the other characters, like that doctor, you know, come over and have new actors playing them, and then you do, like, a little arc with the
Enterprise
crew. I mean,
you can, yeah, it depends on when. They have the flexibility, is what I'm saying. Like, if they want to, they can have the TOS cast versus the Pike pilot cast.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't think so.
It doesn't matter, though.
I mean, sir,
I'm saying they have the flexibility.
I don't think so, though, because this isn't close enough to TOS that I don't think it would make any sense to have. I mean, they explicitly said regain distress call from Captain Pike.
Mm.
I think Kirk was supposed to have been the captain of the Enterprise longer than people like Sulu and Scotty and Uhura, certainly Chekhov, who didn't even appear to the second season, were
right.
serving on it.
Mm-hmm.
Kirk and Spock had known each other for a long time. Obviously, Kirk had known McCoy for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if you had like an early in Kirk service, it would be Kirk and McCoy and Spock, but
right.
they're not going to do that. They said it was Pike. So I think mm-hmm. we're going to get recast versions of the people that we saw only in that one unaired pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's all speculation. But I like where they ended up. Like I like the fact that they were able, I like the fact that even though I thought it was handled a little clumsily, that they were able to win the war by sticking to their ideals.
Mm-hmm.
I think that ultimately it showed the triumph of the sort of the Star Trek ideal over the dark, grim and gritty, warmongering thing that people criticize the show for and that, say, like Lorca
mm-hmm.
embodied.
Mm-hmm.
The show was sort of, as in total, a refutation of that idea and an embracing of the traditional Star Trek philosophy, which I like.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that it ended with that ceremony where Burnham is reinstated. They all get their medals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's... The war is over. We see Paris, and you know everybody's happy. And Sarek and Michael have their little come to their understanding, and Amanda's there too, and everybody's happy. And Stamets gets a medal for Culber.
Sure.
Anyway, I like the way it ended up. I just thought that
if they didn't even 16 or 17
episodes, like maybe do a little less in the Mirror Universe, or just make the season a little longer, or just end it at 13 and continue the war next season. It just the last two episodes for me kind of felt like they stumbled a bit, like they had too much they wanted to finish up, and I don't know why they felt the need to finish up the war.
I'm glad
quickly.
They did, because it kind of clears the slate. And not only that, but they didn't really have a guarantee that they would be renewed, right? This entire thing is an experiment with the CBS subscription service anyway. So they really weren't guaranteed. Okay, yes, they did get a renewal, but by then they only had plans for their 15 episodes and that's it, or 13 and then plus two, or whatever it was.
I mean, you're right, they didn't know they were going to be renewed, but they didn't know they were going to be renewed when they started plotting out the season, right?
That's what I'm saying.
Why did they all of a sudden decide to add two more episodes and
Well, I don't
wrap
know,
the
but they were, given, they were given two episodes, and I think they felt they wanted to wrap it up at that point because they wanted to do something else for season two. Maybe they had plans for season two that didn't have room for the Klingon machinations.
Yeah, I just think that either they changed their minds or they got some dictate from on high or something. I think that they were going to end it at 13 when they got back from the Mirror Universe, but for whatever reason, they said, let's wrap it up and do something different in season two. I just hope it was their choice. Either way, I'm not thrilled with the result, but I'd feel better about it if it was their choice.
I like it.
I did really enjoy it, but I do see to me the first few episodes are really good. Then we start to get a few kind of standalone get to know the crew of the Discovery thing, like the one with the time loop and the ones with Harry Mudd.
Yeah,
those were all great. The mid-season finale was great, where they do all the many jumps and they get the data on the Klingon ship.
Yep,
you know, T'Kuvma is killed. Georgiou is avenged. Then they get lost in the Mirror Universe. That was a great cliffhanger. The Mirror Universe stuff was really exciting. To me, it went on maybe like one episode too long, but it had a great, great climax. Really, you know, a lot of great moments.
Yep.
I was 100% on board. At that point, the show kind of peaked. And then to me, the last two episodes were like, it went from like, you know, high 90s to like 80s or something like that. Like, it wasn't a huge drop off in quality. I'm just like, I structurally, just, to me, there's some weirdness here with the pacing and everything. And even in this last episode, if this is going to be the episode where you end the war,
yeah,
they spent like 30 minutes out of 45 just like wandering around the Orion embassy on Kronos.
I liked it.
That was all entertaining.
I liked it. That was great.
That was all entertaining stuff. But if this is your big season finale where you're going to end the war between the Klingons and the Federation, mm-hmm. it's an odd choice to spend half of the episode having fun with Clint Howard. And have Tilly breathing just like stylistically, tonally, like
I was there for it. I enjoyed it.
Think it would be the big, huge action climax that the Escape from the Mirror Universe was. Like that had character stuff and huge spectacle, which is kind of what you want in the season finale of a big sci-fi show. This just felt really low for something where Kronos was going to be destroyed and the Klingon ships were literally approaching Earth. It just felt super low stakes. Like it ended up just being a bunch of characters. Having a not too tense chat in a cave handing a device around like hot potato.
But that's the culmination of what it was. That's the culmination of the point.
I understand thematically what was going on, but just viscerally, it felt like a bunch of characters standing around talking.
But it was the meat of the conversation that was the important part, and I was there for it like 100% because this was the moment where Burnham almost does another mutiny, but in service of actually saying, no, this is not what Starfleet mission is all about, and this is not who Starfleet is, this is not what we're about, and you admirals who are making the decision to, because of months of being war-torn, have changed from and strayed away from the overall mission, and I will remind you of that. That was where the drama really was for me. And in the end, the cleverness of handing over the keys to the entire Kronos planet to a Klingon was a meisterstroke. It was a brilliant move that I did not see coming. She Lorel, like, will definitely unite the factions and make one Klingon united race, you know, united planet. And I think that that's an important jumping stone, too, because when we meet the Klingons later on down the line in TOS and whatever else and down this timeline, they're already united as a race. And I think that's super important to establish, and they did that successfully here. And for me, the fact that it didn't have a lot of spectacle and debacle and, like, action, I didn't feel robbed by any sense of the imagination because it was more of a mental, a cerebral exercise than it was anything else. And I was there for it 100%.
I loved it. I appreciate all those things about it too, but I still can't help feeling like it could have used the structure of it could have used a bit more escalation or something. Like to me, the best... there are huge...
Blowing up a planet, the threat of that happening is not enough.
Yeah, but the characters
drama?
Most of the characters didn't seem... The way they were comporting themselves on in the Orion embassy there seemed like they were sort of vaguely concerned, but it didn't seem like they weren't. What you want is like them running like in the J.J. Abrams movies, right?
Oh,
where they're running down the halls and like
that's everybody everywhere. Yeah,
no, but I mean, but it just felt like.
They didn't know what threat they were under. This
no,
is
I know,
why it
but
was,
it just structurally it felt
but
a little
it's
strange.
So
to me.
True too, because those people on the planet did not know how close they came
like,
to complete total.
Believe me, I've watched thousands of hours of Star Trek. Uh-huh. I am on board for characters standing around talking about their morality, like that.
Yeah, Next Gen is your favorite.
If you're not on board with that, then you're not going to get Star Trek. But to me, the very best epic Star Trek finales, be they season finales or finales to two-parters or whatever, like, you know, Best of Both Worlds or whatever, or some of the great Deep Space Nine two-parters, managed to balance great character moments and themes and philosophy with exciting action.
Sure.
And not all Star Trek does that, but like the best... You know, event Star Trek does that. Even the movies, to a certain extent, like some of the best character moments for the original cast were in movies like Wrath of Khan and Undiscovered Country, and those had fantastic action scenes too. Like the whole battle in the
like
Mutara Nebula
between
Kirk and Khan in Wrath of Khan is one of the most iconic battles in science fiction history. And that movie is all about character, like Khan's character, Kirk's character, and Spock's character. So to me, it could have used a little bit more of that dash of daring do and a little less of exploration of like Orion culture and all that stuff. I enjoyed the Star Trekiness of it, but it just felt like the structure of the season just felt like it was like in the American present, like they had a thing hanging out there. There was a thing hanging out there, you know, like there was this huge action climax getting back from the Mirror Universe, but then there's still more show. There's two more episodes and I'm like, oh, but You know, you just viscerally, you feel like you've had the climax. Mm-hmm. It's like people say about the third Lord of the Rings movie, which I don't necessarily agree with, but it's like
how had people had like 14 endings.
Yeah, like you had the thrilling ending, and you feel the catharsis, and that you're tearing up because the characters and the heroic sacrifice. But then there's like another hour of movie. You're like, it's all good stuff, but just your brain has been trained by a lifetime of watching three act structure things to know, like, we've had the thrilling climax. Why am I still here? Like, right. you feel like the story should be over by now, either to be continued or...
Well, this is an AI, you know, that Steven Spielberg did the same thing. He had, like, 15 movie endings.
Your brain feels like it should be the denouement by this point. Like, you've had the big thrilling escape from the mirror universe, and now you wrap up the character threads and you tie a little bow on it, or you do to be continued with a cliffhanger. You don't have the action start to rise again. It's just, it's a weird way of structuring the season.
I mean, that's maybe the formula that people are used to, but I was there for this. This was maybe a little off format, yeah, because it didn't follow the rules of whatever structure has been set forth that every single season finale has to have XYZ components. I don't know.
When you
just
see,
artistically speaking, like, that was, I think, unique and really special, and I really dug it. I was there for 100%.
There's some great epic... really action-y but yet still character-rich stuff coming up that you haven't seen. There's some great Voyager two-parters. The last couple of seasons of Deep Space Nine are thick with great action and battles, yet really interesting character development. And I feel like structurally and pacing-wise, those shows really nail that. Like, there's not, when you get to the end of Deep Space Nine, there isn't a huge resolution and then another 2 hours of the characters standing around talking about the morality. It's paced in such a way that, you know, the finale, you know, take it or leave it, but it's you never feel like you're just, wait, should I?
Well,
you know,
I didn't feel that here, so I feel know. Like that. I don't know. It's just a difference of opinion.
Maybe when you see those, I'll be able to say, no, remember how the other one, and sort sure. of, you know, compare and contrast, but obviously we
I don't know. I just enjoyed yet. It. I just, no, I just
loved I really it. Enjoyed it. I'm just saying I would give it maybe like a B plus as opposed to the A, the A or A plus that I've been giving like the past seven or eight episodes.
I'm giving it an A.
All right.
But yeah, it was a great show, and Black Lightning continues to be a great show. I wanted to tell you about the time that the times that I was tearing up, but I'm sure that show will make me tear up again, because it is just so, it's such a good human experience show, and I love it.
Do you think it's realistic that the guy, I can't remember his name, but Jennifer's boyfriend who was crippled?
Oh,
do you think it's...
What is his name?
It doesn't matter. Do you think it's realistic that he would... I mean, we haven't seen his response to Tobias right. Whale's overtures yeah. yet, but to me, it's like, man, have you never seen a movie or a TV show yeah, or seriously. Anything? Like, a weird guy...
Tries to appears buy your in your room
in the middle
gifts.
Of the night
yeah.
and gives you all sorts of stuff for free and says, you know, this guy that your entire city considers a hero
yeah.
and objectively was there to protect you when yeah. you were shot, yeah. he's actually the guy responsible for your woes. It's like, I'm not sure anybody...
This guy is so together, and I would be really disappointed if they actually...
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like,
he knows what he wants.
If they showed him as being like... really distraught, and yeah. it would be understandable if he was really distraught, but if they showed him being like really distraught and angry at the world and stuff yeah. like, you know, then it would be a little easier to believe that he might be swayed by
right,
a
exactly.
benefactor.
Yeah.
But he seems so
well put together,
so at ease. It's like, oh, I get, like, he was obviously upset when he learned that he would probably never walk again,
yeah.
but he wasn't like, get out of my room, throwing stuff, right, like angry right, at the right. world kind of thing. So because he seems like he's got such a good head on his shoulders,
he seemed that way before the accident too. I mean, he's
yeah,
so
no,
driven.
He seems consistent so right. far, but it's like, I wonder if the point of the show is going to be Tobias Whale just picked the wrong mark, like this kid is not going to fall for it.
Oh,
but then that's a
that
weird
so
that's
nice,
a weird way
though.
To go with the show. Then why did you just spend time on, you know, like, that's not the way shows are traditionally structured. You don't show your big villain enacts his secret plan to undermine the hero, but then just nobody's having it, so he gives up and tries something else. Like,
right.
that'd be a weird thing to do. So something tells me it's going to work somehow, but I wonder how they're going to write that character in such a way that it's plausible that he might fall for it. Because what could Tobias Whale even say to him? Like, yeah, Black Lightning was there.
Yeah.
But and he doesn't know that Tobias Whale was there and that it was his
bullet that
underling
shot
that shot him. But I mean, what would the argument? Is it just the traditional superhero, like the people who hate
probably
Batman
is.
Argument,
yeah.
being like, oh, he escalates things, but
it'll be exactly what's going on with the first victim.
He escalates situations and
yeah.
makes things worse
exactly.
by making things more violent. And I guess, but it seems to me that. The character, if it was more of like a Batman character, mm-hmm. where the people weren't quite sure what to feel about him, that would
right.
be one thing. But it seems like Black Lightning has been so mythologized by this community, by
yep.
everybody except like Henderson and the police
right.
and like
exactly.
the criminals,
yep.
that I mean, I guess this kid is not, I mean, how old would this kid have been when Black Lightning disappeared? Like 8 or 9, right? So maybe yeah, he only know, maybe he know, mm-hmm. he only knows what he's been told. He's not quite sure what to think. I guess it could work more so
but
than...
But he's seen him in action since then, you know? So yeah, he knows the one
time,
the same
just the time that he was shot. Yeah. So, I mean, it could, maybe there's something there to prey on, but mm-hmm. To me, it would have to be written very, very carefully to make it seem like...
Yeah, the establishing rules for this particular character are so hard and fast. Like, yeah, he's a very certain young man.
If they'd written him as more of a, and it would, you could do
a malleable,
it. Like, well, yeah, just like he could still be yeah. a nice guy. He could still be really driven, but driven in sort of like a more arrogant way. Like he knows he's the fastest runner and he's going to be awesome one day. He's going to be rich. He's going to get his family. Not self-aggrandizing sure. way, but like, I know I'm the best, so I'm going to prove it. And I'm going to pull my family out of this bad circumstances and I'm going to have it all right. Like in that sort of self-fulfilling, you know, I can eye on
well,
the prize
I mean,
kind
hang
of way.
Because that's kind of how he was written, so I really need a better distinction.
But he seems
for,
so. But he's more down to earth about it.
He is
it, right?
more down to
like,
earth.
Like he seems
yeah,
so selfless
exactly.
and kind about it. Yeah. If he was written as a bit more of a, maybe just a bit more
immature.
Self-centered. Like he wants a little
I
bit of the fame. He wants a little
of,
bit of the limelight.
Yeah, you're right.
And the
right.
fact that
the
now he can't
of,
get that mm-hmm. would be maybe what pushes him a little bit. But
right. Because this is a very mature
wants,
young boy.
If all he wants
he
is money
presented.
To pull his family out of the bad circumstances, the fact that he has a rich benefactor now, like his problems are solved, right? Like he doesn't need to hate Black Lightning if this guy's willing to give him all, you know what I mean? So it's, I don't know. We'll have to see how they do it. But well,
yeah, I hope that, I just hope that.
You know what would have been more interesting?
Tobias, so, let me finish my sentence. I just hope that Tobias Whale kind of does fall flat on his face. That would be the most interesting thing to resolve from the cliffhanger. Like
if he gets beached?
Yes, exactly. No, this, 17-year-old boy just kind of beaches him, and then he becomes the next Mark. You know what I mean? Like,
you know what
that
was,
would be interesting.
You know what I'm saying? Might have been more interesting. What if Tobias, and maybe this will be what happens next, what if Tobias Whale sees that this kid isn't really falling for it mm-hmm. and sets his sights on Jennifer? Because Jennifer is the one that seems more
yeah.
angry with what happened. She doesn't know that her father is Black Lightning.
Right.
So what if he's like, look what happened to your boyfriend. It's all because of Black Lightning. She's got a lot of anger. She already has a rebellious streak,
yep.
which is what this
yep.
the boyfriend does not have,
yep.
like I was saying.
Mm-hmm.
And what if he starts to pray on her, like, look, you know, you can get justice for this guy you really care about. You can
yep.
set him and his family up if you just, you know, do what I say. And then
right.
you've got the interesting family drama of she's being pitted against her father,
yep.
but neither of them knows it. Tobias Whale doesn't even know that he's unwittingly
right.
pitting father against daughter.
Yep.
That might be interesting.
That would be, that's a heck of a curve.
Because
yeah.
it practically writes itself. They establish she's spending mm-hmm. more time than her parents like visiting the boyfriend in the hospital.
Yep.
She happens to come in one day when Tobias Whale is there
mm-hmm.
and Tobias Whale sees something in her that he knows might play into his plans
mm-hmm.
and then it just goes from there.
Mm-hmm.
That might be interesting.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Or this might be a way of having Jennifer step up a little bit where Tobias Whale is successful in preying on her boyfriend a little
mm-hmm.
bit, but she's smart enough to see what's happening
mm-hmm.
and she steps up to try to push back against him a little bit and in that way starts her own sort of heroic arc.
Yeah.
Depends on whether they want to take her character up or whether they want to bring her
but
down a little
still,
bit before
yes.
they build her back up, like they did with Laurel in Arrow.
I
you
say,
got to break her down before you build her up.
To that idea, I say yes, but because it brings back the original problem of Luke or whatever his name is.
It definitely wasn't that.
I don't know. I have a lot of L names in my things because of Lala and whatever.
It was like
Lucy
Deshaun
or
something like that. It wasn't Luke.
No,
like, it
I don't
was not,
remember
like, not
what
kind
his,
of name.
I don't remember what his name is. He's a sweetheart, but I don't remember what his name is. Anyway, because of how his character was established, like it brings back the original problem of him being swayed in the first place, because I just don't buy that, you know, at the current status quo, I just don't buy that he would be swayed by the dark side, as it were. But we'll see how they do, because this show is great.
I almost made a really tasteless albino joke where it's like, is it the dark side if it's Tobias Whale? It'd almost be like being swayed by the white side. I'm not quite sure what.
So that's, you need to apologize for that. That's bad form. Anyway. Do you have anything else to add?
Nope.
Okay, so if you want to reach out to us, we are on Twitter at Smarts Podcast. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/smartspodcast. Our website is www.smartspodcast.com, and our email address is mailbag@smartspodcast.com. And how about a funny sound? He's shaking his head.
You must make one.
Okay.
Is that lightning? I
yeah.
think you did that already, didn't you?
Did I?
Did we do like a zap lightning sound already?
Well, we did a sad zap, but this one's...
All right.
I was working on it.